Erin Klabo is a neuroscientist, science writer, and teacher based at the University of Virginia. She joined us to talk about her work and research.
You're listening to Psych Talk.
So, Erin, thanks for joining us on Psych Talk.
Thank you for having me.
I want to bounce between lots of different things you do, and you do really have an interesting resume that you, so many different sides that could all be careers of their own. I'm thinking you have an evil twin or a clone, maybe two. But so let's start with one of your evil twins. Your graduate work with mice and your work on Huntington's disease. So maybe if you can help our listeners learn a little bit about what Huntington's is and then go into what you were looking into about it.
Sure. Huntington's disease is one of these kind of rare genetic disorders that's called autosomal dominant, which mm-hmm. means that if one parent has a copy of the defect in their gene, that they will pass it down with 100% penetrance, but 50% of their children will end up with the disease. So if you have the DNA that has a mutation in it, you will get the disease. It's just a matter of time. So there's not that many of these genetic disorders out there, and it's a great kind of model to use to figure out exactly how the genetic disorders are passed down. So this was one of the very first diseases that was gene mapping was done on to try to figure out where exactly the mutation was in what piece of DNA that it was. So Huntington's is actually, it's on chromosome 4 where the DNA has a defect that kind of gets elongated. And it translates into a protein called the Huntington protein. And with that comes an extension of a CAG repeat. So it ends up that you have a protein that on one end, kind of near one of the end terminus, it's got basically like it's longer. And because it's longer, it looks like it changes the way the protein balls up within the cell, and it changes interactions with all its normal partners, and it can make just a cascade of problems within the cell.
Right. Well, that was a very nice wrap-up description. So I want to point out a few things about that or clarify, I guess. So it's funny, usually when I guess in the media is reporting about the genetic basis of disorders, there's this cartoonish idea that there's like a gene for schizophrenia or a gene for something else that's really polygenetic and really complex and there's no one gene for it. But in this case, there really is a gene for Huntington's disease, right?
There really is. It's one of the simplest kind of genetic disorders that's out there because there's not really a lot of things, you know, if you have five kind of schizophrenic-like genes from your father and three from your mother, then you'll probably end up getting schizophrenia. I mean, this is just an example, but for this one, you can absolutely trace it back to your dad or your mother, and they then can trace it back to their dad or their mother. So it's definitely just passed down from generation to generation. Really, actually, a tragic disease because most times the person doesn't know that they have the disease until they're in their 30s or 40s. So it's something that you're completely normal for the beginning of your life. And as your neurons age and the damage builds up, then after you've already decided for the most part to have kids or not, then you find out that you have the disease. So it's,
right, that's,
you know,
very
there's
sad.
A test out there. There's a genetic test that some people choose to have the testing done and to know, and other people decide that they don't want that information and they'd rather live their life not knowing.
Mm-hmm. So then clearly this is a very worthwhile disease to study. It's a model disease, but it's also a tragic disease. People who have it want as much redress as science can provide, right? So the sort of work you were doing definitely wasn't just theoretical, although you were working with mice and you were looking at the genetic structure of Huntington. So what questions were you trying to answer? Where were you drilling in?
So the question that we were trying to answer is, what is the Huntington protein, which everybody has and all mammals have all the way down like to fruit flies? What is this protein actually doing? Because nobody knew what its normal function was. So I did my research with Dr. Scott Zeitland at University of Virginia, and he was trying to answer these questions by making mice that either were missing certain parts of the Huntington protein to try to look at them and see what deficits they had. And then from that, you can say, okay, well, then the X part of the protein is responsible for this deficit.
Mm-hmm.
But really, the mice that I made they were missing the polyglutamine repeat. So remember I said that there was this expansion. So the glutamine is the part of the protein that instead of, you know, a couple of glutamines, you should have, you know, seven or so. Then you end up having, in the case of Huntington's, 34 up to 120 repeats of this protein when you have the disease. But nobody knows why you have the repeat to begin with. So that's what I was trying to do, is try to figure out what exactly this repeat was doing normally in normal people.
That's interesting. I'm interested in this idea of you counting the number of repeats. Is there some number of repeats you can have and still be safe, or is there some threshold? And are there different degrees of Huntington, sort of dose dependent, or how does that work?
Yeah, so in a mouse, all mice have 7 repeats. In a human, normally it's anywhere from about 10 to 28 or so, and there can be normal variability from person to person. But you definitely have a threshold, and the kind of magic number is 36. So anything under 36 and the protein seems to fold normally and it's not pathological. You get over 36 and then you get the disease.
Is it known why that is the threshold, or did your research shed any light on that?
Well, my personal hypothesis is just that when you get too many more than 36, when it changes the conformation of the protein, so the whole thing is folded differently. So that means that different sites that are supposed to bind to other proteins or perform jobs in the cells, they're just hidden. They're tucked into there like a ball of spaghetti. And you can't, the proteins that are supposed to bind to the inside of the protein, that, you know, it'll be tucked away when it's normally accessible. So they won't be able to function properly.
Right. Well, I guess the last thing I want to do with understanding this research is just to walk listeners a little bit through what's required to set up an experiment. Like, for example, how do you get the mice you need to do the sort of work where you're comparing mice with Huntington's to mice without Huntington's?
Sure. This was my first couple of years of just learning, you know, how do you go about generating a mouse model? Because I didn't know at all coming in to a genetics lab. And pretty much what you have to do is you have to start with some DNA. So we had a patient that had donated a fragment of their DNA that we could use that human sequence. And then I took out the glutamine stretch. We did this just by, you can kind of order amino acids that are in line, and then you can use things called, well, I guess it's kind of complicated, but you basically can cut out the part that you don't want, and you can use things that are naturally occurring in the environment to slide the new DNA back in there so you have exactly the sequence you want. And then the next step that you do, you do all this in bacteria. You use the bacteria as tools because you can make lots of bacteria grow up in a dish.
Right.
You kind of do it in their DNA. And then once you have enough DNA and it's proper, the mutation that you're looking for, then you take them and you try to put them into an embryonic stem cell that will become a mouse. So it's a mouse embryonic stem cell. And once you do that, you find the one, you screen lots and lots and lots of them, and you find the one that is actually properly integrated where it's supposed to be. And then you can take those embryonic stem cells with your DNA of interest, and you can then put them into mice. And then they'll grow. They're basically called pseudo-pregnant. So it's mice that think they're pregnant, but they're really not. So their bodies are already kind of going down the pregnancy path. And then you put them in a couple days into the pregnancy, and they will have the babies as their own, and they will raise them. And then you screen the animals that are born and just make sure that everything still looks okay. And then you set up breeding, and then you do the testing when they get older to just see what kind of deficits they have.
That's really fascinating. Well, so that's how you get the mice. And then what I want to jump to is the implications of, as you reflect on the work you did for research with stem cells. I mean, it's hard to speak about such a broad issue and it can get controversial, but just from your experience, how much of what you did could have been done without using a mouse model and without using stem cells, do you think?
Zero.
Zero.
The mouse models, I mean, just the genetic tools that we have to manipulate them, it's incredible how well researched, and there's so many people that have done it now that you can kind of, I mean, it's years and years of work, but right now you can go and just order something that somebody's already done years and years of work on and use that mouse in a different way to ask a different question. You don't have to start from scratch.
Right.
And in terms of the stem cells, you know, these weren't human embryonic stem cells. So having mouse embryonic stem cells is a great, great resource because in many ways they can act the same as humans. Now, you can't really give mouse embryonic stem cells to a human and hope that they're going to replace neurons or do some kind of other, you know, regenerative therapy. But they are a very valuable tool for basic research. And I've, you know, also the work I'm doing now, I know we haven't gotten to it, but I work with stem cells again, you know, in my current job, looking at diabetic retinopathy. And it's these are actually human cells, but they're not the very controversial embryonic human stem cells. They're, you know, adult-derived stem cells. And those have been also extremely valuable because they don't come with all of those moral implications. It's kind of, you can sidestep the question a little bit, and they're still valuable.
Right. Well, you gave us a good transition there. I do want to talk about diabetic retinopathy and about your current work. So let's just start by talking about what that is, what diabetic retinopathy is.
Sure. So diabetic retinopathy is a disease of the eye that happens to people who have diabetes. And it's a very common complication from diabetes. The longer the person has diabetes, the more likely they are to get this ocular problem. And I would say probably 40 to 45% of Americans who have diabetes actually have diabetic retinopathy. And what it is, it's basically the blood vessels in your eye, in your retina, are very susceptible to glucose levels. And when you have uncontrollable glucose levels, as you often do in diabetes, it can really damage the little tiny capillaries in the blood vessels in the back of the eye.
So basically, glucose, when it's in levels that are too high in the blood, starts to become toxic in some sense.
Yes.
to the eye. Mm. And you say 40 to 45% of diabetics have this, or are we talking type 2 diabetics, or does it matter?
It can be either, type 2 and type 1.
I see. So then, I'm actually pretty ignorant about diabetes, but is this something that a diabetic person would be very aware of, that their doctor would talk to them about, and that they might get some kind of therapy for today?
Well, there's not really any therapy for it. It's just something that you need to monitor. Mm. So I would think that someone who had diabetes, or the 40 to 45% are people with a diabetes diagnosis. I think the problem comes when somebody doesn't know they have diabetes, which I know there's a lot of undiagnosed people with diabetes. And also sometimes diabetic retinopathy has no warning signs. So there's an early stage and a later stage. So I think often you can be in the early stage of diabetic retinopathy with undiagnosed diabetes and not really know that you should be visiting, you know, the eye doctor until it's too late and you start getting signs.
Right. Well, that's ominous. But on the bright side, you're working toward a solution. You're working. Tell me about what you're doing with adult stem cells, as you were saying, what you think you might be able to do as a therapy.
Sure. So these are adult-derived stem cells. So we get them from adults, and they're derived from fat, which another word for that is adipose tissue. So they're called human adipose-derived stem cells. And it's really, this is kind of what hooked me into the lab that I'm working in now. It's such a neat story. So there are people who go into the medical center to have liposuction procedures, then they donate their fat, and we can take the stem cells, so there's like a stem cell population in there, and we divide it away from the rest of the cells that are in there, and we can grow them up in culture, and we can actually inject them into the eyes of mice who have diabetes. This is another one of these genetic tools that we're using where you can order. There's several mouse models out there with diabetes, and we can pick the one that works best for what we're trying to see, and then we can see if injecting these stem cells in the eyes can help replace the parasite population that's been lost.
Wow. And it's not as if there's some computer program that models a diabetic organism, right? At the moment, there's a whole body of knowledge around animal research and nothing nearly equivalent that could give as much insight, right?
No, I don't really know of anything because there are things that a computer, I don't know, that could model. For example, we need to know if we inject these cells into the eye, what exactly do they turn into? So do they become something else when we've injected in a fat cell? When they get in there, do they get all these signals? Are there eye signals that, you know, they can receive that says, oh, we're in the eye now, so let's become an eye cell? Or, you know, we don't know about inflammation. You know, these are human cells we're putting into a mouse. It'd be nice to know if the body is just going to attack them as a foreign body or a foreign cell. So these things are really hard to do on a computer.
Right. The detail about how you get these stem cells is somehow surprising to me. Is there something in particular about fat, about adipose tissue, that makes it easier to find stem cells, adult stem cells in there?
Well, there's these things called mesenchymal stem cells, and the two most common ones are bone-derived and adipose, so fat. And they're used for a wide variety of things in regenerative medicine, but fat cells is just so easy to get compared to bone cells. So I think the ease of access and the fact that you could maybe eventually in the future have somebody who donates their own stem cells to be used back in them as a therapy. It's just such a fascinating idea and so worth working on. You don't have any problems with kind of like a donor issue, or, you know, you can go in, have some liposuction done, and then put it, you know, in your eye. Of course, I mean, this is not really happening, but just the idea of it is something to work towards, to use your own cells to treat yourself.
Right. That is such a nice story. Something to look forward to. Well, with the mice research, we talked about the mice themselves, but of course there are people in that lab too. While we're talking about your current work on diabetic retinopathy, let's think about the team of people you work with. I just want to emphasize this idea that science is usually not an individual endeavor. So if you could talk about your role with respect to, I guess, the principal investigator and other people with whatever different focuses and skill sets.
Sure. We have a big team, actually. So I work with a retinal surgeon named Paul Yates at University of Virginia, and he is our eye person. And then we also collaborate very closely with a doctor called Shane Pierce-Kotler, and she is a biomedical engineer. So this is where the whole aspect of using these cells in a novel way to cure something in the body comes in. She's worked with these cells for years, using other things like injecting them into muscles for different disorders. So they teamed up together to say, let's use Shane's expertise on these cells in the eye, which is Paul Yates' expertise, together. So our lab works with her lab on, you know, all of this. But also in my lab, there's, you know, several graduate students and some technicians. I'm the only postdoc in there right now. It's a relatively small lab. But undergrads as well. So it's very collaborative. You know, you have collaborative lab meetings, and it kind of depends on what your niche is. If you're a graduate student, you're kind of expected to do everything from start to finish, so you have your own project. For a postdoc, I kind of throw in where I'm best at to try to help the project move along to get a paper published, which is kind of the end result that you want.
Right. So you might be working with multiple grad students or with Paul Yates himself or with wherever you need, you're saying.
Right. And I also, you know, I'm doing training. So I have an undergrad that I work closely with who is a neuroscience major. And so, you know, I kind of bring this neuroscience aspect to the lab that's more of an eye lab. So I think that's my role, is to say, hey, guys, remember, we're neuroscience, too. The retina's part of the brain, remember?
Right. Yeah, it's interesting. This is a little bit of a sidetrack, but people think of their eyes and their sensory apparatuses, you know, whatever, the sense of touch in their skin is unrelated to their nervous system or to what their brain's processing. That's a little bit of an illusion, right?
Yeah, it is. Well, and the retina, I like to say that the retina is the only part of the central nervous system you can see from outside the body.
Interesting.
So, yeah, if you look with an ophthalmoscope into the back of the eye, you can actually see the retina.
Hmm. I guess unless you chip away someone's skull, then there's another way. Okay. So we've talked about your research, and I've made a sufficient number of morbid comments on that. Let's jump to your other work, your other evil twin. For example, you've been a neuropsychological technician. And so tell me a little bit more about what the context was and what that was like.
Sure. That was a neat job. That was my first real job out of college. And I worked as an intern there when I was a psychology major. You know, you can do an internship for a semester if you want to hook up with somebody in a psychological field. So I found somebody who was a neuropsychologist in Richmond and kind of came in once a week for a semester, and then he offered me a job after I graduated. So I did that, and he did a lot of medical cases, legal cases, some malingering stuff. I don't know if you know about malingering, but this is where somebody says that they have brain injury, but they really don't because they're in a court case, and so they're faking. So we did a lot of kind of targeted assessments to try to figure out if somebody really did have memory loss or if they were pretending.
That sounds tough, because usually I think cognitive assessments depend on the person working with you and being honest. And if you have to work around what they're telling you, it sounds like you have to be really precise and cautious, and might still be a high error rate. I don't know. What do you think about that?
Yeah, you do, but there are a couple of tests that have been designed specifically to pick up cheaters. They pretty much are all based on this 50% rule. So if you're trying to fail, you're going to be getting more than 50% wrong. And if you really are just guessing, you should be about 50%.
That's interesting. So people don't understand randomness, and they give themselves away.
They just want to be really, really bad at something. Don't say no to exercise. Don't get every question wrong.
Right. Well, you mentioned there are all kinds of medical and legal referrals. Was there any pattern to the patients who came? Was there like a broad spectrum of severity of potential brain injury?
We did some car accidents where you have a traumatic brain injury. We did ADD assessments for kids or ADHD. We did a lot of stroke victims, unfortunately, or dementia for older people. So they have like a mini mental status exam that they're given at their doctors, and if they don't do well on it, it's not that many questions, then they may be referred to us. We'll run a more extensive battery, starting with questions like, you know, what year is it, who's the president, and kind of getting a little bit more difficult.
Right. So usually be a doctor or some legal team, like a prosecutor defense team, that's going to make the referral?
Yeah, usually we have them referred by doctors. You do have the occasional, it's not that common for somebody to fake a brain injury. So we did have those, which were kind of sensationalized, which is probably why I remember them more vividly than some of the other ones. But generally the doctor would do a referral, and then, or schools sometimes would refer a child.
I see.
I loved being in the clinical setting. I'm not so much in the clinical setting anymore, but that's kind of where my roots are.
Well, yeah, your research definitely has clinical applications, so you're not too far from your roots.
That's true. That's true.
Mm-hmm. A third out of the four hats I want to talk about is that you've done a lot of writing and I guess also editing of science writing. So I'd love to hear about that.
Well, this story was something that I didn't really intend to do, but while I was writing up my thesis in graduate school, I realized I was just really good at that, taking this hard scientific concepts and kind of converting them into something that made sense and made a story. And so right after I got the PhD, I took a couple years and I just did science writing. And I didn't really know how to start, because there's not a lot of career training. And when you're getting a PhD in neuroscience, they kind of just assume that you're going to go into a lab and become a professor or go into industry. And so I just kind of decided one day that I wanted to be a science writer, a medical writer, and I printed up these free 100 business cards with my name on it and science writer. And I had left one at my mom's house on the counter, and her neighbor had come in, and she picked it up and said, "I have a medical communications company. I need a science writer right now for this project that we're working on headache. Your daughter would be perfect." So that's how the first job happened. And
that's
I've been working with her, on and off for years now. And then I ended up doing freelance work, and a lot of my work has been sales training for the pharmaceutical industry. So if they have a drug that is like an allergy medication and they need to sell allergy medication to the doctors, somebody needs to write the materials to train their sales reps how to be able to sell it to the doctor, or just so that they are knowledgeable enough about it so when the doctor asks them questions, they can answer it.
Right. So when you're writing this information for the sales reps, are you putting in information in a way that makes it easier for the sales rep to make a pitch, or is it like objectively informational, or what's your perspective on how slanted what you're writing might have been?
Yeah, not slanted at all. They have a huge legal department in most companies where it has to go through, and it has to be extremely rigorously referenced, and no slant or pitch at all. You write it more like a textbook. You give them the information. Now, there are some aspects of things where the marketing department has a say of how they want you to word something, but they have to be really careful that legal approves everything. So that was kind of a new world for me that I had never been in. I had to kind of learn what they wanted and what they didn't ever want to see. And I did make that mistake in the first one or two projects I worked on where I was trying to help them sell it, but that is not my job when I'm doing it. I'm just giving them the tools so that they know what they're talking about.
Okay. So you were giving them the tools. And did you have access to confidential research, or what data were you working with when you're compiling this?
Yeah, so usually if there's a clinical study or studies, I'll need to sign a confidentiality agreement, and then I'll have the documents I need to be able to base my training materials off of that.
Right, and I guess usually these will be studies that were submitted or will be submitted to the FDA.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and if I'm not wrong, usually the records of studies registered with the FDA are not public, right? People can't go see the results of all the studies that are submitted to the FDA. Is that true?
Well, generally, most companies will want to publish, especially if it's positive results on their part, then they'll want to get it out there so that it can be cited and doctors can see it. I know that if there's ever a claim that a pharmaceutical company makes and they have the reference that's internal, it'll always say the name of the country, or sorry, the company, and then data on file. And it's my assumption that you could just go and ask, and if they have made the claim, then they'll have to produce the document, but it's not something that it's really easily accessible for the public.
Right. Yeah, that was just my impression that it wasn't easy. I just heard in recent news that some professor had filed a Freedom of Information Act request and had gotten some records of negative trials of some company. So that's the only reason it was on my mind.
Yeah, I would think that they might not make that very easy if it was bad data, but they're supposed
right.
to.
I see. Do you have any tips for the idealists out there to help make that situation better? You know, have bad data be available as well? Maybe you have an inside perspective on how that would be politically possible?
Well, I don't really have a take on it, because all I see is data that is good enough to launch a product, because that's what I'm doing. I'm working on these products that are out there, and for the most part, I haven't really seen that much negative data.
I see.
I mean, by the time it gets to me, they're saying, this product's actually working and we need to try to sell it. So the worst that I'll see is them say, play down this part of the trial where it looks like this isn't a very tolerable product, but play up how effective it is.
I see. I guess that makes sense. So in your position, there's only so much you can do, right? You can't say, show me every negative trial. but you were putting together what objective information you could from the data you had. Well, I don't want to hold you too long, so I do want to jump to the last thing that I found very cool about you, which is that you're teaching programs at Duke. What you're teaching is biology of the brain, and I think maybe now you're doing the neuroscience of personality or something similarly broad. And I guess I'd love to hear just one bite-sized bit of what you're talking about and how it's exciting or interesting.
Sure. This has been such a neat experience for me. So the Duke TIP program is Talent Identification Program. And it takes these gifted high schoolers that have an interest in something, and it gives them either, depending on whether it's a seminar course or an actual course, the kind of a college experience a little bit. Very specifically on one thing. So right now I'm teaching this personality, neurobiology of personality, and I'm running it kind of like a seminar that you would get at a college, where the kids have reading assignments and they have, you know, movies and other kind of extra things, and then they come together with me once a week, and I'll basically give them a 45-minute seminar using PowerPoint and anecdotes and things that I find really cool and engaging about the brain. So this past week was learning about the neuron. So what is a neuron? And I had them watch this Flash movie about the neurons talking to each other. And it was just so cool how they got it. And they were like, this is awesome. And how does this relate to this drug? And they were just right there with me when we were talking about the synapse. So in terms of what we do, it's pretty much like a seminar during the year. And then the summer course is more homework and more involved with grades and things like that, whereas during the year, it's kind of just informational purposes, you know, just to enrich.
Right. That sounds really fun. And I think actually what you're doing, I guess it's in one sense, it's a very unique experience for these high schoolers because they're getting a college level seminar. But on the other hand, it sounds like you're providing something that should be literacy for our generation. I think talk of brains and neurons and synapses are entering the popular awareness. And so it's helpful for everyone to know what that actually means, sort of the way people all have DNA as part of their lexicon and their awareness after the last few decades. So I think what you're teaching is pretty broadly important.
I agree.
That's my opinion.
And especially with, you know, the amount of kids who seem to be on some kind of drugs these days, not recreational, but I mean like ADD medications or antidepressants or things like that. I guarantee you every kid in that class knows somebody who's on one of those. And so it's important that they understand what exactly is happening and that nobody really knows how these SSRIs work. They just seem to be effective. These things are important when, you know, you're a teenager, you know, you're starting to get to the age that you have some say in kind of what you want to do with your body and whether you want to be on something or not be on something. So I think it's very helpful for them to have all the information before they make a decision or talk to a friend about it.
Right. Yeah, maybe one parting thought we can have is that the brain is pretty complicated and that even the people who devote themselves to studying to it don't know all the answers, don't know why some drugs work. That you know, it's not as simple as switching one gate on or off, right?
It's true. Sometimes something just works and people go with it for years and years without even ever knowing how it works. Just look for the effect. So, yeah, you can spend your entire life not just on one part of the brain, not just on one neuron, but like on one tiny protein within that one neuron, and you can have a whole career just figuring out exactly what that protein does. It's amazing the amount of information that's still waiting to be discovered in the brain.
I hope that talking with you will inspire any listeners to go into neuroscience, that we have some young listeners who will jump on board and help us explore this crazy machine in our heads.
Thanks so much for having me.
It was great having you on.
It was a pleasure.
Check us out at psychtalkradio.com to find podcasts, contribute ideas, and learn more about each Psych Talk show. We're also on Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter. Volunteer to play the trivia challenge by calling 919-438-1927. Thanks for listening.